So, if I'm not mistaken, this is lecture six. We hastily finished writing down the Lagrangian for the standard model last time. And now our job is to break its symmetry. But first, let's just get it back on the... We always have sort of the same bit of data we want to be looking at here. A little beginning of the class ritual. I'll try to write this quickly. So I have my quarks, Q left, U right, and D right. I have my leptons, L left, nu right for later, and E right. And then, okay, so those are my fermions, and then my scalar field is the Higgs, but then last time we also introduced Higgs twiddle, which is I sigma 2 times Higgs star, the complex conjugate of the Higgs doublet. Okay, so the quarks are all triplets under SU3, everybody else is a singlet. Quarks are all, the left-handed guys are doublets under SU2, as are the Higgs and Higgs twiddle fields. Everybody else is, doesn't transform under SU2. And then the hypercharges are some weird pattern we want to explain later in the course, or try to explain. Okay, great. So then we wrote down the Lagrangian as follows. So we said there was the kinetic term for the gauge bosons. So the kinetic term for the strong field, strong force. The kinetic term for the SU2 gauge bosons. The kinetic term for the U1 gauge boson. Great, those are the kinetic terms for the spin 1 fields. Then we had the kinetic term for the Higgs. And the corresponding potential terms for the Higgs. How come when Ruth writes on the board, chalk seems to only look white, and when I write on the board, somehow I can make it look black? I don't understand. Is there some trick about chalk that I don't know? Somehow, no matter how hard I push it, I don't know. Anyway, okay. Okay, great. And so those are all the terms involving purely the scalar fields. Then we had the kinetic terms for the fermion fields. Like this. What the hell? And then, okay, and maybe I'll omit new right today, because we won't be dealing with new right. And then last time, we spent a lot of time talking about getting the Yukawa terms in the right form. So we said there were three independent ones. There's one where Q left couples through a 3x3 diagonal matrix to the Higgs and the right-handed quark. And then there's another one where Q left couples instead. So now in this next term, we again found we couldn't completely diagonalize it. So there was this leftover unitary matrix, the CKM matrix. And then times our diagonal real matrix, Y sub U, little y sub U, coupling through the Higgs twiddle, coupling to the Higgs twiddle and the right-handed up quark. And then finally, the analog of this term, but for leptons. So the left-handed lepton doublet coupling through a diagonal 3x3 real matrix Y sub E to the Higgs and the right-handed electron. And then I forgot to write this last time, but plus the Hermitian conjugate of these terms. This line, the Hermitian conjugate is different. Okay, and then, so now are we done? Remember, our goal was to write down every guy that was Poincaré invariant, gauge invariant, real, and dimension, where the operators in the term have dimension less than or equal to 4, so the Lagrangian is renormalizable. So are we done? Almost. We're roughly speaking, we're done, but there is another set of terms we can that seem like they satisfy all of those conditions. So let's write those down. Here's line 5. Okay, what we can do is, so we built this guy, we built this kind of object, the field strength, which transformed like a tensor. And so in the normal kinetic term, we write down two of those next to each other. So we have 4 Lorentz indices, and then each of these is a 3x3 matrix, which we've multiplied. So now if we take the trace of this matrix, we said that is enough to now make this thing gauge invariant, but we still need to make it Lorentz invariant. So now in the normal kinetic term, we make it Lorentz invariant by contracting these guys using the metric tensor, which is one of the invariant tensors you have available to you in Lorentz in special relativity. So in that case, we contracted them, you know, to raise these two indices, we contracted them like this, alpha with gamma, and then beta with delta, where eta is the inverse metric here, Minkowski metric. Okay, but there's another invariant tensor we could use here, which is the epsilon tensor. Epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. That will also give a non-zero answer, and so that's another term that we can write down. And the coefficient in front of this term is traditionally called theta. This is usually called a theta term. So I'll write theta 3 here in front of the term built from G, and then there's an analogous term I could write down here with theta 2 involving W mu, W alpha beta, W gamma delta, and a final term theta 1, which I could write down involving B, B alpha beta, B gamma delta. Okay, so for just like I could write down 3 kinetic terms here where I've contracted the indices using etas, using 2 etas, I can write down the analogous 3 terms here, but now I contract the Lorentz indices using epsilon. Okay, so we will get back to these terms later in the course when we talk about the strong CP problem. But for now, I just want to make a few comments. The first thing is that classically, these terms don't matter in the sense that classically, you know, what's the name of the game? We write the action. And then classically what you do with the action is you vary it with respect to some field that it depends on. So we vary it with respect to some field A, set that variation to 0, and that equation gives us the equation of motion for A, the classical equation of motion for A. Well, it turns out, and we'll see this more later, but for now, just take my word for it. If you vary the gauge field G, then you get non-trivial terms coming from this term. So you get some non-trivial contribution to the left-hand side of this equation. But from this term, you just get 0. It does not contribute to the equations of motion. And same with this guy if you vary W, same with this guy if you vary B. Okay, so classically they don't affect the equations of motion. Classically they're irrelevant. We could just ignore them. Okay, but it turns out that quantum mechanically, in principle,
they can be important. Well, actually not these two. These two will turn out to be unphysical, even quantum mechanically. We'll talk about why that is later. This one, though, is a puzzle. This one should be physical. If this coefficient is non-zero, this term should imply that the neutron has a non-zero electric dipole moment. In practice, there's a puzzle, though, which is that we measure the neutron's electric dipole moment to be zero very precisely. Okay? So we might naively have expected this coefficient to be some order one number, but in practice, when we measure the neutron's electric dipole moment, we find that it's so small, I mean, we find that it's zero plus or minus something that is so small, the error bar is so small that we know that theta, if it is non-zero, has to be less than about one part in a billion, has to be less than about 10 to the minus 9. So maybe this term is there, and this thing is just, for some reason, very small, less than 10 to the minus 9. Or maybe, for some reason, this term is also unphysical for a reason that we don't yet understand. But any way you look at it, this is a puzzle called the strong CP problem. This term should be present, seems to be allowed by the same rules which let us write down the rest of the standard model Lagrangian. And yet we don't observe its effects. And why we don't is called the strong CP problem. We'll get back to that. That's a famous problem in the standard model. Okay, but so modulo the fact that we will get back to discussing this line later in the course when we talk about the strong CP problem. For the most part, I will ignore this line. I won't write this line for the rest of the, probably for the rest of the first half of the course. And we'll just deal with those previous four lines and understanding what they're about. Okay, yes. Either of you, go for it.
Okay, I had a question about the three families of the three copies.
Mm-hmm.
I that we have.
Mm-hmm. The three generations or three families.
So it seems that in the Lagrangian, for example, for the kinetic term, if I'm taking a unitary mixture of electron and muons, for example, or something that won't appear. But then what allows us to say this is an electron, this is a muon?
Mm-hmm.
If they could be mixed, then it would give the same terms. And
yeah, that's a very good question. You know what? Actually, that's something that I'll be talking about later in this lecture. So it might be easier to explain. But so what I want to say is that if this line was not present, then the different families would be particles with there would be no measurable difference between their properties, and so there would be no unambiguous way to say, you know, this basis vector in field space is the muon, this basis vector in field space is the electron. But because these lines are both present, there will be a measurable difference between the different families. One way to say it is that the quarks in the different families of the same type, the fermions in the same family of the same type. So for example, like you said, the electron, the muon, and the tau, which all occupy the same line in the table, they do have different properties. So in particular, the most apparent one is that they have three different masses. So when they propagate, at a fixed energy, they propagate at different speeds. And then in addition, they have more subtle different properties, which is that they branch into one another in different ways due to their interactions and Feynman diagrams. I imagine that's confusing at the moment, but I'm gonna be trying to explain that better later in the lecture. Yeah.
So I'm assuming the quark oscillation is gonna come from the QL bar terms there.
Did you say quark oscillation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we break the symmetry, can we try to do it with like a similar mechanism for neutrinos by adding the right-handed neutrino and adding the term that we wrote last time, but not this?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's yes, indeed. So because we couldn't, because we can't define away absorb this this unitary matrix here, we'll have this phenomenon that the basis of of fields, which is diagonal in the sense of diagonalizing the mass matrix, the mass eigenbasis, is different than the one that diagonalizes the interactions with the gauge fields, sometimes called the flavor eigenbasis. And so there will be oscillations in the quark sector in the standard model. On the other hand, the fact that we did successfully diagonalize all the lepton terms here means that there won't be that phenomenon in the lepton sector, according to the standard model. Now, in 1998, people observed that there was oscillation going on in the lepton sector also. The neutrinos were oscillating. So that showed that this Lagrangian that I've written up on the board is wrong. So indeed, one of the leading explanations for that is exactly the one that you mentioned. You include the right-handed neutrino, so then you do have a fourth term here, which is very analogous to this term. You can't diagonalize very much in an analogy with this, and you get neutrino oscillation. So indeed, that's one possible explanation for the neutrino oscillations, and I'll be going more carefully through that in a few lectures down the road. But yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
I was just wondering, I think last time when you wrote it, the VCKM matrix was in the first term. So is it like equivalent?
I shouldn't mess up that convention. That's a good point. Thank you. Sorry. I'm confused all of a sudden. So I previously wrote the CKM matrix in the term with D right. Is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Yeah.
Okay, let me just double check. I want to say that was a... Oh, crap, I didn't bring my notes from last time. But that is a... That's an error. I mean, that's not the conventional thing to do. Sorry, I did that backwards last time. Sorry about that. So the more ultimately it's equivalent. You can redefine the field so that VCKM appears here or here. I'm sorry. I had it right last time. Sorry. Excuse me. I think I must have been my Okay, I take it back. I made the error this time. Sorry. You're saying if I move VCKM to here, that's what I did in the last lecture?
Yep.
Okay, actually, that's also what I have in my current notes, so that must be right. Yeah, sorry about that. I just got confused. So, okay. Does that agree with what I wrote last time? Yes. Okay. Good. So, thanks for catching that. So the next thing I wanted to say was. So I worried that before we count up what are the independent physical parameters here, I worried that I rushed the last point about the CKM matrix last time. So let me just quickly make sure that wasn't messed up. Okay, so we had managed to write things in that form. Okay, so we
We had started with capital Y's here, capital Y sub D and capital Y sub U. And then we had said without loss of generality, we can do this singular value decomposition where we write this as, write this guy as VD dagger, little y UD, and this guy as VU dagger, little y U sub U. And then, okay, we absorbed these two guys. We said we could absorb these two unitaries into these two fields without undiagonalizing their kinetic terms. And then we could absorb one of these guys, let's say this one, into this guy's, into this, into a field redefinition of this field without messing up its kinetic term. But then we were stuck over here. We didn't have room to absorb. There's one unitary left over we didn't have room to absorb, which is why the CKM matrix is appearing here. Okay, so then we switched to field. We did that change of variables, dropped the primes, and now we have our new Lagrangian, which looks, which has these two terms. And then there's a last important, seems like a detail, but I'll explain, it's an important physical point that in the history of the standard model, and a Nobel Prize was given for it, so let's try to understand that point. So far we've been trying to absorb as many of the free parameters as possible into field redefinitions. Since if we can do that, those aren't, you know, those aren't physical parameters. Those just have to do with our choice of variables. So how much room do we have left to absorb more of the parameters in this matrix? So that we said this is a unitary matrix. In principle, it has 9 real parameters in it. So we know that we're free. We know that we're free to absorb unitaries into these three fields without messing up their kinetic terms. And so the question is, so we've brought this thing to the form of a real diagonal matrix, and this thing to the form of a real diagonal matrix times a unitary matrix. The question is, are there further unitary matrices that we can absorb into these three fields that change this unitary matrix, absorb some of its free parameters, without ultimately changing the basic form we've got things into, without changing this real diagonal matrix or this real diagonal matrix, only changing that unitary? And the answer is yes. So let's imagine that we what we can still do without messing up these real diagonal, the fact that these are real diagonal matrices, is we can absorb unitaries that are just diagonal matrices with phases along the diagonal. So if we send Q left J to e to the I gamma J Q left J, and we send U right J to e to the I beta J U right J, and then we send D right J to e to the I alpha J D right J. Well, that's like, you know, that's like just inserting the diagonal matrix e to the I beta 1, beta 2, beta 3 here, and the matrix e to the minus I gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3 here. Now, since all three of these matrices are diagonal, I can bring the gamma matrix through, so it hits the beta matrix. And if I want this to remain a real diagonal matrix, those two matrices of phases should cancel in this term. Okay, so in other words, I have to choose, I have to make sure to not mess up this term, I have to choose that gamma j is equal to beta j in this transformation. Yeah, so that nothing happens to this term. I don't mess up what I've already achieved. So these three parameters and these three parameters are not independent of one another. So we can just convert this one to beta j. Okay, and now let's look at this guy. In general,
So here I will have stuck in this matrix, this diagonal matrix, e to the I, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, here. And then I'll have stuck in the matrix e to the minus I, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, here. Fine, I'll commute, since this matrix is diagonal and this one is, it commutes right through it. So good, I have my diagonal real matrix is left unchanged, and all that's happened is that I've sent V, C, K, M to the diagonal matrix of the minus betas, e to the minus beta j, 1, 2, 3, times the old VCKM times the diagonal matrix e to the plus I alphas on this side. Okay, so I've sandwiched VCKM between two different diagonal matrices of phases, and so and both of which will, you know, this is not a diagonal matrix, so this won't commute through. This will, both of these will change the relative phases of the different columns or the different rows in this matrix. And so, but it's all just a field redefinition. So this looks like there's, of the 9 parameters that I thought I had in here, there's 6 parameters of freedom to change the matrix, but not quite, because if all the alpha j's were equal to each other, and all the beta j's were equal to each other and to the alpha j's, then this matrix would just be proportional to the identity matrix times a phase, and this would be the identity matrix times the opposite phase. That would pass right through and cancel one another. So one of these 6 parameters doesn't do anything to VCKM. The other 5 do. So at the end of the day, VCKM has 9. It originally had 9 as a general unitary matrix, but we're able to, 5 of those turn out to just be changeable by field redefinitions. So we have 9 minus 5 equals 4 real parameters in VCKM. Okay, why is that important? Well, an important question is whether by a field redefinition we can just change VCKM into a completely real matrix, okay? So if this was a unitary matrix, but what's the real, if we had been able to turn this into a real unitary matrix, well, a real unitary matrix is just an orthogonal 3x3 matrix. So can we turn it into an element of O3, the 3x3 orthogonal matrices? Well, according to this, no, because you know, a 3x3 orthogonal matrix, that's a 3-dimensional rotation. You know from, let's say, studying classical tops and you know from, hopefully from your classical mechanics course, that a rotation in 3 dimensions involves 3 real angles, an arbitrary 3-dimensional rotation. So, you know, you choose some axis that you're going to rotate about. So that's picking 2 angles. And then you choose how much you're going to rotate around it by. That's the third angle. So there's 3 real parameters in this. On the other hand, there's 4 real parameters in VCKM. So that must mean that in addition to the 3 real angles, there must be 1 complex phase, unremovable complex phase, a real genuine physical phase, complex number, appearing in the coefficients of the standard model. And so, as we'll come back to later, that turns out to be the test for if a theory is CP violating. So if you can take a gauge theory, like the standard model, and by redefining fields, you can remove all of the complex numbers from the coefficients. You can convert all of the coefficients in the Lagrangian to real numbers. Then that theory, it might violate C, it might violate P, but it respects the combined symmetry CP. But since we've just found that we cannot remove all of the complex numbers from VCKM by a field redefinition, that means the standard model violates CP. And in fact, this was famously the way that Kobayashi and Moskawa discovered, theoretically, that the standard model should have a third generation of fermions back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, people doing experiments with mesons at collider experiments with mesons found that there were CP violating effects in the standard model, in the decays of mesons. And Kobayashi and Moskawa realized that if you did this argument with the ordinary standard model as it was then understood with 2 generations of fermions, If you go through the analogous argument, you'll find you can absorb all of the phases. If you go through the same counting argument I just did, you can absorb all the phases. The only thing that's left is a real 2x2 mixing matrix, the Kabibo matrix. So it wasn't compatible with the observed CP violation, so they hypothesized back then, as it turns out correctly, that there was a third generation of fermions, because that seemed like the simplest way to get CP violation in the standard model. Okay, so anyway. Good. So let's just do a little tally of the number of parameters we have. So there's the whole Lagrangian of the standard model. We've soaked up all the parameters we can. So what is left? Well, first of all, in defining these, in defining the gauge fields and how they interact with the standard model fields, we had to introduce three gauge couplings, G1, G2, and G3. Okay, so that's three. And then on this line, to define the scalar potential, we had to introduce two more, the mass parameter for the Higgs and its quadratic self-coupling lambda. Nothing new on this line. And then on this line, well, we had three, so that's two more. And then on this line, we had three diagonal real matrices, YD, YU, and YE. So that's 3 times 3 is 9. And then we have VCKM. So that's everything on this line. And then on this line, well, we had three more parameters appearing here, but again, we'll see that these two are unphysical. That one, in principle, should be physical, so we'll count it. And so there we have the standard model is this formula. What we found is that the most general formula we can write down that satisfies those four criteria, starting from that table, has this many free parameters in it, which have not been determined in any way by our argument. As far as satisfying those criteria are concerned, these are just real numbers that we don't know what they are. They have to be determined by experiment. Okay, so we see that there's 19 here, if I've done this correctly. This is plus 4, and then plus 1. So this should be 5 plus 9 is 13, 17. Nope. Okay, sorry. 5 plus 4 is 9, plus another 9 is 18, plus 1 is 19. Good. Thank heavens. Okay, so there's these 19 free parameters in the ordinary standard model without including right-handed neutrinos and without accounting for neutrino oscillations. And by now, all of these parameters have been measured quite precisely, okay? And so what is the status of this model as it stands? What does it do right? What does it do wrong? So this model, until the late 90s, until neutrino oscillations came along, it described all laboratory tests on Earth, all laboratory experiments we've done on Earth. So all laboratory tests, except neutrino oscillations. Okay, and then also all tests in the solar system. Well, before I say that, we should talk about the real, let's say, standard model at the moment, which is this theory coupled to gravity. Okay, so far we've been talking about the Lagrangian for the standard model fields living in flat space-time. It's all been special relativity so far. We haven't allowed curved space-time, and so we haven't allowed any gravitational effects. So in practice, actually, the theory that we actually test in laboratories and the theory that we need to explain observations on the Earth and in the solar system is this theory coupled to GR. So if that Lagrangian is L standard model, then the theory that we actually use, let's call it S standard model prime, the theory coupled to gravity, looks as follows. Let's say S, let's say the action for the standard model. Let's call it S standard model prime would be the integral over space-time of the square root of minus the metric determinant. And then, well, what terms appear here? In addition to the standard model Lagrangian, we also add the Einstein-Hilbert term, which describes usual general relativity. So this is basically m Planck squared over 2 times the Ricci scalar. Hopefully you've met that Lagrangian in your GR courses, or if you haven't, you certainly will in Ruth's course. And then finally, there's one other term we can add here, which is the just a constant, the vacuum energy. Okay, so once we add this coupling, the standard coupling to general relativity, this theory describes all the laboratory tests and all tests in the solar system. Now, once you go out to bigger scales, once you make it out to the Milky Way galaxy, well, then it's not so clear. They're already puzzling things begin to emerge, but it's the evidence for dark matter in our own galaxy is not nearly as the evidence for by dark matter. Let me just say for now, the evidence that this theory is failing is not so clear at the scale of our own galaxy. But once you begin looking out at other galaxies, and in particular trying to study the universe as a whole, then we know this theory just can't. We'll be discussing this more later, but this theory just cannot get the job done. And so anyway, something else going on, which is usually taken to be dark matter, although we'll discuss what the evidence for and against is. But okay. So that's one thing I wanted to say. Where does it work and where doesn't it work? So it really does a stupendous amount right. But then it's clear it's not the whole story already in the Earth due to neutrino oscillations and then cosmologically due to a number of other phenomena that it can't explain. Another thing it can't explain here is the observed matter antimatter asymmetry of the universe. It can't explain the primordial spectrum of density perturbations that we observe in the CMB. So once you get out to cosmology, there are a bunch of things it's clear that this model by itself can't explain. Okay, so that's the good news and the bad news about this model. So it's a supremely good approximation to the truth, whatever that is. So let's pause and mention. So there's a lot of puzzles about this model that we'll meet as we go along through the course. But let's just pause now to mention a few. So the first thing is that you might pause now that we've laid out the standard model, the model that works. You might ask sort of why about every step along the way. So why did we choose the gauge group that we did, SU3 times SU2 times U1? That was chosen to match observations, but is there some deeper explanation for where it came from? And then after that, you might ask, why did we choose the representation that we did? This table we wrote down, which somehow is the most succinct encoding of what we've figured out about the fundamental laws of nature. You know, where does this table come from? Why are there 6 different irreducible representations of fermions? why do they transform in these particular representations and in particular with this weird list of charges? Why is there only one line of scalar fields here, and why does it have the, why does it transform in the representation that it does? An obvious question is why does the whole fermionic pattern get repeated three times? Apparently not related to any of the symmetries that we've seen so far. So I guess I would add why three generations is a kind of separate question here. Okay, so those are all, in some sense, questions about where that table came from. But then we wrote down the Lagrangian, and we said that I had previously said that the table was enough to completely determine the Lagrangian, but as we just saw, that's not really quite true. There's now 19 real numbers that appear in the Lagrangian that are physically significant, but we don't know where any of them came from. So, you know, we just determine those by experiment. But can we explain any of those numbers? Can we maybe predict some relationships that had to be true between those numbers or something like that? So the next thing is that there are, so we'll be discussing a little bit later in this first half of the course, and then more in the second half of the course, there are a number of proposed explanations that help explain the questions on the first line. Some of those look so good that they seem likely to be on the right track somehow, but also there's bad news, so they look likely to not be quite the right answer. We'll be discussing, there's also some progress in explaining some of these numbers, although not, there are some intriguing ideas that have been given, although nothing that works so well that everyone can agree that it's right. But then another question is, in addition to explaining these things from first principles, another thing that, even if you can't explain them from first principles, another thing that jumps out is that some of the values are very strange. They're unexpectedly different from what you might naively expect. So this is kind of a fuzzier question, but there seem to be various tuning problems in the standard model. So one of the tuning problems I mentioned is that there's this dimensionless number here, and for some reason it appears to be less than 10 to the minus 9. So that's strong CP. Another one which is worth mentioning now is that if you look at the coupling to gravity, okay, so suppose we didn't know, suppose you were a primitive human being who did not know gravity existed, but you had somehow managed to discover the standard model, okay? It's not how things went historically because we have, you know, so in practice, actually, the three forces appearing here are huge compared to the gravitational force. So for example, if you take, you know, two protons and you ask for their gravitational attraction and you ask for their electric repulsion, you know, the gravitational attraction between them is stupendously small compared with the electric repulsion, force of electric repulsion. So in some, from a fundamental physicist standpoint, gravity is very weak. On the other hand, you happen to be standing on a very big ball of many, many protons. And so its gravitational force is very big. And so, in fact, due to that kind of, due to your location bias, your species discovered the rules of gravity before these rules. Let's imagine it went the other way. Let's imagine somehow you discovered this thing first, the stronger, you worked out the theory of the stronger forces first, and I didn't tell you these other terms yet. Well, let's look at this Lagrangian. One notable thing here is that of all the 19 parameters in it, all of them are dimensionless except for one. Okay, there's only one dimensionful parameter appearing here. And that parameter is has dimensions of its size. It has units of energy, and its energy is about a TeV, which is, in other words, I don't know how familiar you are with these units. Let me just pause for a second. So an EV is an electron volt. How much energy you pick up when you accelerate an electron through 1 volt of electric potential. So a GeV is about the mass of a proton. 1,000 times that is a TeV. So this is 10 to the 3 GeV, basically 10 to the 3 times the mass of a proton. So that's the one dimensionful number that appears in that Lagrangian, and that's the dimensionful number that governs all of standard model physics. That's the roughly speaking, the energy at which spontaneous symmetry breaking happens. That's the VeV of the Higgs. That's the governing number in standard model physics, because it is the value of the only dimensionful parameter appearing in that Lagrange. So if all you knew about was the standard model and you didn't know about gravity, you would say, oh, great. There is one natural dimensionful scale in physics, the TeV scale. Everything should be roughly around there, and I'll judge everything compared to that, bigness or smallness compared to that. So then I tell you, oh, no, actually, there's this other force, too, I hadn't told you about. It's weaker, but so here's its Lagrangian. And you would be stunned by this, because this, so the one dimensionful guy appearing in here was 10 to the 3 GeV. But now M. Planck is huge compared to that. M. Planck is 10 to the 19 GeV, so 10 to the 16 times higher. And then rho vac, which is the cosmological constant. This is sometimes written, another way to write this is M. Planck squared times lambda, the cosmological constant. But anyway, this thing has dimensions of mass to the fourth. So to get something with dimensions of mass or dimensions of energy, you have to take the fourth root of this. So if you take rho vac to the 1/4, then that must be about, then that should be 10 to the minus 12 GeV, I think. So you would be stunned by how big this coefficient was, and you would be stunned by how small this mass scale was. In some sense, it's saying that compared with what a particle physicist would expect, there's a huge cost to curving spacetime, huge cost in energy. Curving spacetime a tiny little bit, huge cost in action, I meant to say. Curving space a tiny bit changes the action a ton, okay? On the other hand, there's a very minuscule cost to stretching spacetime. So this term is just a constant times the volume of spacetime. That's what this first term is. This term is just proportional to the volume of spacetime. So as you stretch spacetime, this is saying there's almost no change in the action due to stretching spacetime. And so, or stated another way, this is saying somehow gravity is incredibly weak. You need a lot of mass to bend spacetime. And this one is saying, this term is responsible for the fact that the universe is accelerating, which also was only discovered about 2 decades ago. And another way to say this is that the naive expectation, if this thing had been as big as, if this had been of order the TeV scale, the acceleration would be much, 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 much faster than it is now. Well, we would have been wiped out. We wouldn't be here. Instead, the acceleration is so slow that can only just barely detect it and have only recently managed to detect it. And that's coming from the fact that this is so much smaller than the naive expectation. So that's another puzzle. This is the huge difference between this scale and this scale is usually called the hierarchy problem. So if you, all of these things where two dimensional scales in the same Lagrangian are stupendously different from one another are called hierarchy problems. But this one is, if you hear someone say the hierarchy problem, they're usually referring to the difference between these two scales. Somehow high energy physicists were really obsessed with this one for the past few decades. almost to the exclusion of other things to some extent. Anyway, this is another enormous hierarchy between the cosmological constant and the Planck scale, or between the cosmological constant and the electroweak scale. One thing, by the way, to notice that's kind of interesting is that no one has quite made a perfect story out of this, but maybe it's an important hint, maybe it's just numerology, is that, you know, if you take these three scales, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the 18, and 10 to the 3, that the electroweak scale is roughly the geometric mean of the other two. So this guy, 10 to the 3 GeV, is roughly M Planck times rho times the vacuum energy scale, their geometric mean. Anyway, that may be a hint about something, maybe not. As I say, people have tried and so far not come up with any great explanation for that, but something to keep in mind. Okay, any questions? Uh-oh, I forgot to pause. Let's belatedly pause. Did anyone write a limerick? I know the previous one was intimidating. It was intimidatingly good. Okay, I unfortunately didn't write one either. Let me see. I have, instead, this is random, I just brought a poem I like, which is short enough that it fits in the allotted space. So this is this Emily Dickinson poem, Because I Could Not Stop for Death. It's a kind of lugubrious break from previous funny poetry. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. Or rather, he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill for only gossamer, my gown, my tippet, and my tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then, 'tis centuries, and yet feel shorter than the day I first surmised the horses' heads were towards eternity. It's a great poem. And I have an interpretation of this poem, which is that I should probably get on, you know, death is coming soon, and I should move on with the lecture, or else we'll never get to the, oh, thank you. This is AKA, also known as the Higgs mechanism. Okay, so what's the story? So we wrote down this Lagrangian, and we know, since we've written it down and constructed it for this purpose, we know it has this full gauge symmetry, SU3 times SU2 times U1. Okay, but we also wrote down the potential for the Higgs field, and it has this form that it's minus m squared plus lambda, minus m squared h squared plus lambda h to the fourth. So it looks something like this, and then, so this is if we plot v of h here, and then this is h, okay, but h has two complex components, and each of those has two real numbers. So really, this is a four-dimensional space, but the size of the potential only depends on the on this combination. The potential only depends on this combination, the absolute value of h squared. So if h is, if you write it as 1 over root 2 times some real numbers, phi 1 plus I phi 2, and then phi 3 plus I phi 4, then h dagger h is 1 half phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared plus phi 4 squared. So the the value of the potential only depends on the radius in this four-dimensional field space. And there's some minimum of the potential which occurs at some value of this radius, the Higgs-Vev squared. Let me write it as following this convention, 1/2 times the Higgs-Vev squared. And so so the bottom line is that this is some three sphere. The minimum of the potential, I've drawn it here as a circle because I can't draw in four dimensions, but in four dimensions it's some three-dimensional sphere, the three-dimensional solution of this equation. And so in the real world, the Higgs will not want to sit up here because that's not its lowest energy configuration. It wants to sit somewhere at the bottom of its potential. And so what we want to do, we've currently been working with this variable, which describes our excursion away from this point. But to do perturbative quantum field theory, which is our normal way of understanding the physics of some Lagrangian, we want to do perturbations around where the field is actually sitting so that the perturbations are small. So we need to change from H to the perturbed value of the field to the constant vacuum expectation value of the field, the place where the field is sitting everywhere in space to a zeroth approximation, and then consider small fluctuations about that. Okay, so the first, so what we'll do as following convention is we will rewrite our previous field little h as zero, and then the vacuum expectation value v, this is just a constant, a number, the value of the potential at its minimum, the value of the field radius at the place where the potential is minimized, and then plus some perturbed field, which I'll call capital H. Okay, this will now be a single real scalar field. Okay, so what has happened here? Sorry, my shoe has come untied. Before I kill myself, I'll retie this. But so what has happened here? This is so-called unitary gauge. We've used the gauge freedom of the standard model. Remember, H transforms as a doublet under SU2. So we can do an SU2 transformation. So let's say we started out, and here's space-time. Okay, and over every point in space-time, we had this Higgs doublet. So we had two scalar fields, a doublet of two complex numbers. What we're going to do is we're going to apply an SU2 transformation U2. I don't know why I'm drawing this so small. So over each point in space, we have a doublet of complex numbers. But we also have this gauge symmetry. The whole theory is invariant under a local gauge symmetry. I can do a symmetry transformation at each point. And so I can always choose a matrix U2 at each point in space so that I take the value of the Higgs field at that place and rotate that 2x2 complex number so that, first of all, it has zero in its upper component, and secondly, the bottom component is real, okay? And that's called going to unitary gauge. So unitary gauge means I choose I do a symmetry transformation to choose the gauge in which this is zero and a real number. And then I can now write my real number as the vacuum expectation value v, which is just a number. Again, this is some constant number with dimensions of mass everywhere in space, which is measured to be 246 GeV. We'll see how that's, we'll learn how that's measured later, but.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
It's not my lecture since 3 minutes ago.
Oh.
Take 2 more minutes to finish up.
Sure, Eric, yes. Thank you. I didn't realize that you started right after me. So, and is that?
It's just this week.
You're just this week, oh, okay. Uh-huh.
But just this week, my lecture was moved to,
Okay, sounds good. So, Okay, well, I'll finish by saying that you know, the name of the game now is to plug this expression into that Lagrangian and figure out what the physical interpretation of the resulting expression is. And so in particular, to just very briefly summarize the story, which we'll then unpack next time, you know, it looks, looking at that expression, it looks like we have 8 plus 3 plus 1 massless gauge fields. Four real scalar fields in the Higgs doublet. And a whole bunch of 15 or 16 times 3 generations of massless Weyl fermions. And what we want to see next time is that when we plug in the VEV, this so-called Higgs mechanism takes place. All of these fermions become massive, except for the neutrino. One of these scalars remains a real scalar. That's the so-called Higgs boson. But the other three get eaten by three of these four gauge bosons and made massive. So at the end of the day, we'll have 8 plus 1 massless gauge bosons left over, corresponding to the unbroken symmetries of the standard model, SU3 and U1 electromagnetism. But then we'll also have three massive gauge bosons corresponding to the W plus, W minus, and the Z. OK, we'll pick that up next time.